From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a 10th grade classroom in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. A student named Donna was struggling, but not because she was unable to learn. Donna was attending a private school, and she was gifted. But as her 10th grade year continued, Donna became convinced that she was not worthy. She felt like the teachers and staff treated her differently. And she later felt like that was because her family was low income and because she was African American. Donna never forgot that experience, and the work of her career has always been personal. She's a professor in the College of Education at Vanderbilt. In fact, she's the Cornelius Vanderbilt Endowed Chair in the College of Education there. And the majority of her work is in gifted education and advanced placement. For decades, she's researched and tracked the way students are determined to be gifted or not. She has serious concerns about how limited that view can be regarding what gifted means. And she says that often, it leaves out students of color. So what would it look like if the way students are evaluated for being gifted and talented changed? Dr. Donna Ford is a guest of Nazareth College today. At 4:30 this afternoon, she'll offer a public presentation titled Culturally Responsive Gifted Education and Educators, Models, Resources, and Strategies to Recruit and Retain Underrepresented Students of Color. But first, she's with us in studio, our guest on Connections for the Hour. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Oh, it's very good to be here. Thank you.
Well, and I kind of want to go back to that personal experience, because as you've described in various places over the years, this is personal to you, that you grew up and you had an experience as someone who was very clearly gifted, but also questioning, you know, whether the system had a place for you. What was that like? Tell me about that.
Well, before I do that, I want to thank Laura Jones of Rochester for inviting me to be here for 2 days, but as well as to speak with you so other listeners can learn how serious this issue is about denying access, sometimes deliberately, sometimes not, but we are in a crisis mode in almost every state and city and throughout the United States. But my personal experience as a 10th grader definitely made my decision to go into education and advocate for children like me. I was given an opportunity by teachers who believed in me. But when I went to this private school, there were a couple of teachers, especially the language arts teacher, who just could not wrap her head around the possibility that somebody who was Black and low income could be gifted. Even though I had, I had passed the ABC test, a better chance test, to get invited to any school, private school, that was accepting students, she still did not think I deserved or earned or was worthy.
Did she tell you that? How do you know that she didn't think you deserved it?
It was the way she would talk to me. So, for example, I wrote a paper on the Canterbury Tales, and she thought it was really well done, but she asked me, who helped you with this? And when you get those questions, a lot of times, you're like, okay, well, maybe she thinks I'm cheating. And then another time, we were doing a paper and on the Scarlet Letter, and I decided, based on the negative experiences at that school, that my Scarlet Letter was being Black, and I was starting to have racial identity issues. And she told me she liked the paper, and I was hoping she would have some empathy and start changing her attitude and behavior towards me. So she said, let your classmates hear this. And I refused to do that because it was an all-white female class, and I did not want them to do that. She said, if you don't do it, then you will get an F. So I got an F. And then the last one was reading another writing another paper. And she questioned it, and she said, I don't think you wrote this. You used Cliff's notes. And I said, who is Cliff? And she got upset. I had no idea what Cliff's notes were. So she tore the paper up and gave me another F. So that's at least three examples, but it was something every day, something every day.
You know, yesterday on this program, we had a conversation with the extraordinary cast. What, to our knowledge, is the first ever all-Black, all-deaf cast of August Wilson's Fences being performed here in Rochester over this coming weekend. And, you know, just pointed out among the cast that August Wilson himself, when was growing up and was questioned about, well, did you write this paper? Did you write this story? You know, as if there is some sort of a barrier or a ceiling on achievement or quality.
What I want teachers to know, educators to know, everybody to know, is that your zip code is not your destiny. and your skin color is not your destiny. Stop setting your expectations on where we live, how much families make, and their skin color. Have higher expectations because you are ruining children's education experience and their lives. So what I mean by this is throughout the United States, black students are 19% of the population. There are only 10% of gifted education. So that is like almost a 50% discrepancy. When you look at Hispanic students, they're 25% of our public schools, but 16% of our gifted programs, and that's about a 40%. But when you combine the two, and I want listeners to hear this, when you combine the two, we're talking about slightly over 500,000 black and Hispanic students denied access to gifted programs. So what are those students doing? They are becoming, say, gifted underachievers. They are losing the opportunity to have their dreams fulfilled. And I think that's unethical.
So we're going to talk this hour about what it would look like to change the way we evaluate and decide what gifted truly means, because certainly, your view is that it's much too narrow and, frankly, very white. And so we'll talk about what that means. You use a phrase sometimes when it comes to working with educators, deficit thinking. How do you define what deficit thinking is?
Deficit thinking is not looking at understanding or caring about the strengths that students of color and those who live in poverty have. And is framing words and your attitudes in a pretty negative way. So I have a little quote that says, the less we know about others, the more we make up. And so since too many teachers don't have training in gifted ed and training in multicultural education, they are floundering when it comes to working with students like me who was gifted black, female, and low income. And had I not had a couple of teachers in early years recognize this, I'm not sure I'd be where I am today.
Well, you've pointed out as well that in order to become quote-unquote gifted and talented in the school systems, you need to be what sort of nominated or selected by a teacher. And what we know, this is where I return to one of your opening themes. It's not always malicious, but what we know is sort of like selects like. People who are in positions of power hire people, generally speaking, who look like them. So teachers may select students who are more like them if they're looking for gifted and talented, just based on the data, based on what we understand in kind of research. And the vast majority of teachers in our school systems are white, disproportionately so. So what does it take to sort of kind of get at that issue? What are the various layers there when it comes to selecting students for representation and gifted programs?
So to put a number out there, first of all, about 85% of teachers are white. And of those, 75% are female. So it's a female-dominated profession. Only 7% of teachers are black, and only 7% of teachers are Hispanic. And that is a problem. So universities and schools need to be deliberate, intentional, and unapologetic about trying to make sure they have a diverse teaching pool. When it comes to being assessed as gifted, the first step, and many people don't really talk about this or know this, the first step is to be referred by a teacher. And if a teacher is operating from a deficit thinking perspective, if the teacher is, I just have to say it, racist, sexist, classist, then they're not likely to refer students, and that's happening too much. So I wrote an article a few years ago where I looked at every study I could find on teacher referral of students by race. And what I found was every study in there, black students were under-referred by teachers. I could not find one study where they were referred or over-referred. Hispanics were under-referred 50% of the time. White students, all of the time. Asians, all of the time. So these subjective views about students' potential and these subjective views about what giftedness is and who deserves to be in this these classes, that is really hurting the students and contributing in significant ways, the most significant way, to underrepresentation. So in most states, if you do not get referred, you don't have a chance to be assessed any further for gifted. And so this is one reason I and others recommend universal screening so that all children can have an opportunity to be identified as gifted.
Well, and I think that begins to cover the response to one of the comments we had from a listener. I'm trying to pull up the email because here it is. Clara in Rochester says, I'm a 50-year-old African-American woman. I was tested as gifted in third grade and started attending gifted classes in the fourth grade through high school. One of the gifted schools was in the Rochester area, and then I moved out of state. In California, I attended a gifted middle school and high school. I'm wondering how many schools are testing all students for criteria to determine if they should be placed in gifted programs.
I don't have the percentage right now. There's been a big push, say, perhaps in the last 5 years, but it has increased. Now, I want to give a caveat, and that is just doing universal screening is not enough. You have to set your cut score in a way that you're using local norms, and you have to choose the test that is in the best interest of students. You also have to look at when teachers when you're going to be assessed. So, for example, if you're low income, and I'm not even going to put race on here, but if you're low income and school starts in September and you're getting tested in November, the summer loss is going to significantly lower your scores. And so if teachers do that or administrators do that, that is intentional, because I don't know any teacher who does not know about summer loss. So universal screening with the right test at the right time and in equitable ways.
So you support universal, but again, right test, right time. We're going to return again to the theme of tests, because mm-hmm. one of the things Dr. Ford likes to say is the problem is not, in many cases, it's not the students, it's the test. Get back to that in just a second here. But when you speak more broadly about this issue and you say we need to desegregate our gifted education programs, what's the definition for what that means?
So when I say I want to desegregate gifted programs, of course, in my mind is Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954. So I was an expert witness in a court case that ended in 2013 in Elgin, Illinois, District U46. And I was able to use a formula that is in the EEOC has been using since I think 1970s regarding discrimination in employment. So I adopted that formula, didn't change it. I adopted it. It's called the 80% rule. I was calling it the 20% allowance, and I applied it to that court case, but I apply it to every school district that I work with. So if, for example, black students are 50% of the district, the state, the nation, if you apply that formula, it would be 50 times 0.8. So black students should be a minimum of 40% of that particular setting. And it's the same with Hispanics and any other group. So if Hispanics are 40% of a district, which was the case in U46, then 40 times 0.8 is 32. So they have to go in that district from 2% of Hispanics being in the gifted program to a minimum of 32. That is not a racial quota. That is not a quota at all. That is a formula that you use to make sure you are equitable instead of giving lip service to we want to be equitable. So if you want to desegregate gifted programs, use the 80% rule, apply it, do what it takes to rectify things in your district and become equitable. Now, again, that's a minimum. Hopefully it will be higher instead of just that minimum.
What's the broadest impact of seeing that low of representation for African-American students, Hispanic students, and gifted and talented programs?
Explain what you mean. What's the impact?
What's the impact on those students when they're not selected? When it should be at minimum 32% and it's 2%, for example?
Underachievers. They become underachievers, bored in school, disengaged. Gifted students do drop out. My son, so this is a personal story. My son was, I had a hard time getting him identified as gifted in an all-black school by a white female psychologist. And I wanted him to be admitted into early interest into kindergarten. So he took the test, whichever one it was, I didn't know at that time. And when I came back, she said, your son is culturally incompetent. Now, I'm living in East Cleveland, and that's not something you say to a black person. So I was very insulted. I'm like, what does that mean? She said, he doesn't know what an outlet is. I said, that's called a plug. She said, that's the wrong answer. He doesn't know what a Davenport is. I said, I don't either. She said, that's a couch. He doesn't know what a pasture is. And I said, do you see any grass in East Cleveland? So you're going to call him culturally incompetent? So she said, well, if you put him in a class right now, kindergarten right now, he will be the lowest performing student. But if you wait for a year, he'll be the highest performing. So what did I do? I waited a year, and my son hated school. And by the second grade, he was talking about dropping out of school, hiding in lockers, coming back home as a second grader. And that's why I wrote my first book, Reversing Underachievement Among Gifted Black Students. And I knew what underachievement was because I started underachieving at that private high school. So, again, this is personal. So you just don't reach your potential. And then it verifies to teachers that you really aren't gifted when your grades start dropping.
We're talking to Dr. Donna Ford, who is the Cornelius Vanderbilt Endowed Chair in the College of Education at Vanderbilt University and has spent decades researching gifted, advanced placement, education, and what it means to be gifted in this country. She is in Rochester, among others, as a guest of Nazareth College today, and she has a presentation this afternoon at 4:30 at Nazareth College titled Culturally Responsive Gifted Education and Educators. And she'll be talking about a lot of these themes here. When I get our first phone call, it's from a board member of the Board of Education of Rochester, Willa Powell, calling the program. Hi, Willa, go ahead.
Hello, Evan. Good to talk to you. I'm delighted to hear your expert today. I thought maybe I'd share what Rochester City School District has recently done around gifted and talented. You probably already covered the origins of the federal program. It had federal dollars attached to it, and a student could only qualify based on math and reading scores. So starting in the fourth grade, and that's where we had passed in the MAP program, MAP, Major Achievement Program. And what we had this MAP program in select schools and felt that it was highly inequitable. It made more sense to put the MAP programs where we found the gifted and talented students instead of transferring students from third grade to fourth grade, you know, from one school to another, and concentrating our high achievement in certain schools. You know, that had a huge effect on what schools were considered achieving or not. And one of the impacts of that, we had one school, School 23, had always treated their gifted and talented students differently. Their philosophy, and I think it's right philosophy, is that all children move in and out of giftedness. So if teachers are always looking for the thing that has captured and inspired the imagination of a child, whether it's art or music or science, that special attention should be given to that child in that area. I mean, that's the that's essentially giving every child an individual education plan. And it worked so well that school didn't suffer from the loss of their major achievement program. Every child who would have had resources directed to them through the MAP program were still getting those resources. We saw the opposite in our school number 12, the bilingual program, going right along with what Dr. Ford said. We would have a balanced bilingual program, English speakers and Spanish speakers, in classrooms K through 3. But at the third grade, the white families would apply for the MAP program, even within that building, and would be far and away more successful at getting a MAP placement. And that meant that the two-way bilingual program, starting from the fourth grade through the remainder of the school grades, was no longer balanced. And the
bilingual program was highly challenged to succeed after that point.
Dr. Moore, go ahead. Yeah.
So what you're saying is really somewhat reflective of the court case that I was referring to. So I believe it's called McFadden versus the school district, Illinois School District U46, Elgin, Illinois. Read that court case, and I'm encouraging you and listeners to read that court case, and you will see how discriminatory it is and how it sounds like yours is somewhat reflective of what was happening. So this goes back to an earlier comment, and that was when the caller talked about these programs were put in select schools. That's desegregation. And when which I did last week on a consulting trip, walked throughout this one school building, entire school building, it was racially identifiable. If I looked in a room and saw mostly white and Asian children, I knew that was a gifted program. And if I saw mostly black children and Hispanic children, I knew that was not. And so it is illegal to have racially identifiable programs, and that's very problematic. So there's so many ways to have within school segregation. And there are so many ways to have schools in communities where there are going to be select gifted programs.
So when it comes to the teachers who are selecting the students or nominating them, so to speak here, we had a reporting series 3 years ago. We spent much of the year collecting data on the makeup of teaching staffs in public schools. And it was remarkable in that everyone knew that there's a disparity. But in for some reason in the Rochester area, it's even starker than the national average. So, you know, Dr. Ford mentioned earlier this hour that 85% of public school teachers are white. You know, 3 years ago, it was around 82-83%, so it's in that low to mid-80s range. But in this county, it's 92-93%. There were four districts out of 19 outside the city of Rochester, suburban districts in this county. Four districts have zero African-American teachers, K-12, and four other districts have one. That was 3 years ago, and soon enough, I think within days, we're sending out new notices to districts that we want to update the numbers to see if any of the hiring practices have changed. I want to hit a couple of points here, because so many districts tell us we want diversity in our teaching ranks. It's very difficult for us to even identify candidates of color. You're already shaking your head at that. But they tell us it's very difficult and that you can't just snap your fingers and do that.
Well, it is difficult, but it can be done. Our colleges and universities have to do more recruiting of and retaining of African-American and Hispanic students. They have to go into the schools, P-12 schools, and try to recruit teachers. They have to provide a welcoming, nurturing environment in the university so that teachers of color will want to stay there. School districts, they need to look at lists of students, and they're out there by race who've graduated, and then go and recruit them. The school district should have recruiting fairs and more. It is possible. Now, it's not going to happen overnight. That 92% is not going to become 75%, 50%, and then the rest are going to be teachers of color. But we've got to stop doing lip service or giving lip service to this notion of we want to have more teachers of color. When students are in schools, you have to model that you like teachers. I'm like teaching. So there's a question on one intelligence test that says, how are work and play alike? And the answer is, there's something you enjoy. And when I share that with teachers, they just laugh and like, really? So many of them tell me they don't even like their job, and they're going to model that they don't like it. And when you are suspending students at a high rate, when you are expelling them, black in particular, at a high rate, who's going to be encouraged to teach? I don't know if you have this data, but it's pretty recent. It says that black boys are 9%. Now, it might be 19, so I just want listeners to know it's either 9 or 19% of preschoolers. They are being suspended at a rate of 52%, and that's outrageous. So you already have a little preschooler, a little kindergartner, black boy in particular, not wanting to go to school. So what's going to encourage him to be a teacher? Brings us high school students, middle school students on college campuses so they can see what it looks like. Have them visit classrooms where there's teacher education going on, and they can see start making a decision. How about practicum and internship experiences to let them know what teaching is like? So there are many, many ways. I don't want to change the subject, but I want to go back to this referral issue.
Yes.
I have to say this, and it merges with a couple of your questions or and comments. So going back to the view, to reality that there is under referral, and that is the number one reason. There's also a study by one of my colleagues at Vanderbilt. Their names are Grissom and Redding in 2016. In that study, it was huge in terms of the number of students. They found, and so what they did was they matched Black students to white students by race, I'm sorry, by income, by educational level, by test scores, by grades, matched. So there's no difference other than race. They found that teachers still underreferred Black students at a significant rate. So there's no excuse, like they're matched, still underreferred at a very outstanding, incredibly unjust rate. The second most important finding was that the main time Black students would be identified as gifted, and this goes back to your earlier point, is if they had a Black teacher. So we must get more Black and Hispanic teachers. I'm sorry, teachers in the schools. I wanted to go back to what the caller said. Mm-hmm. And she said that students were identified in math and reading at fourth grade. Now, that's also a problem because that contradicts looking at students' abilities by different subject areas. So it should be math or reading or science or language arts. You can't say, you have to remove that and, replace it with the or, and you will desegregate your gifted programs. Now, this may stun readers, listeners, as well. Most universities do not provide training in gifted education. Most don't. And therefore, the majority of teachers working in gifted education have no training.
So what are they basing their referrals or their evaluation of what gifted means on?
Their subjectivity and what you said earlier. He looks like me, she looks like me, in skin color in particular, and maybe income. Subjectivity.
Your son, who grew up in East Cleveland, having never seen pasture?
Pasture.
Pasture? Didn't mm-hmm. know the word pasture.
And Davenport.
And Davenport is super old school to me, I think. A couch, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about my grandmother used to call. I haven't heard it called since then. My son certainly would not know what that means. But the idea that a young boy growing up in East Cleveland who doesn't see a lot of grass doesn't know what the word pasture means and is therefore disqualified from a gifted mm-hmm. program, mm-hmm. it's pretty remarkable.
It is. And by the way, I told the school psychologist, I don't know what those three are. And I was in a gifted program. I tested into Mensa, the High IQ Society, when I was in, I think it was middle school. My test scores were extremely high. I got accepted to every college I applied to, and I don't know what, I don't use the word outlet, and I don't use those other two words.
Davenport.
So that's culturally assaultive.
You've also mentioned that there's essentially five definitions of gifted from federal guidelines. Mm-hmm. So it's not just intellectually or academically, it's creatively, gifted in performing arts, and leadership. Are those
yes.
are those underrepresented as we evaluate gifted?
That is, very few people have ever asked that question. When Black students, now I don't know about this for Hispanic students, but when Black students are well represented in gifted education, it is in the area of creativity. And that also applies to children in general who are low income. But too many schools don't identify, assess, or serve creativity. The father of creativity is E. Paul Lawrence. And he said that the majority of children who live in low income are creative, and that higher income children tend not to be creative. And so we've got to make that adjustment. And I'm sorry, his name is E. Paul Torrance. We got to make that adjustment. So this is a very interesting point that I want to make. And that is, if you look at if you look at Bloom's hierarchy of intelligence. Bloom, it used to be of those six levels, and I hope readers will look it up or be familiar with them, but of those six levels, the original model had evaluation, which is intelligence or IQ, as the highest level of intelligence. Then creativity was the second highest level. It's switched now. The fifth highest level in the new model of Bloom's taxonomy is intelligence, is evaluation. And the highest level is now creativity. So that should, I want that to be considered. But I heard someone once say, if you give an intelligent child a task, they will complete it. But creatively gifted children find tasks and problems to be solved. So when we look at iPhones and things like that, iPads, it's more like a creative individual than an intelligent individual. So we need to stop just making IQ, meaning intelligence, the number one sought after way to identify children.
Gifted children? Can we train teachers to do that?
Yes, we can. And E. Paul Torrance has a model. He also has what I consider an objective creativity test, which is a Torrance test of creative thinking. In most schools, they don't use that. They make a checklist and it has 10 items, and teachers check it off on creativity. And if a teacher doesn't think you're creative, then you're going to get a low score. That's subjective and that's problematic.
Our guest, go ahead.
And when it comes to intelligence tests, schools usually want to give, like the Wechsler, one of the Wechsler tests, which I think is number one, a Binet test. Those are individual tests of intelligence. And then for the group tests, they almost always give the COGAT, the cognitive abilities test. There are discrepancies by racial groups on those tests, and whites are advantaged and will get a higher score because of those, like those three questions with my son. And then there's the nonverbal test, like the Naegeli nonverbal ability test, where Black, Hispanic, and white children get almost the same score. There are school districts that know that Black students and Hispanic students will get a score comparable to white students and therefore be well represented in gifted programs and deliberately will not use it. And there are a lot of districts doing that. I also want to say, in some states, you get identified by an individual test, and highly educated and wealthy parents will go and get the test, and they will prep their children on it and get high scores. They will go to school psychologists that are willing to be paid to give their child a high IQ score, 130 or above, to get them in a gifted program. So there is a lot of inequity in these tests and what some school psychologists are doing, and is problematic. Last thing, I consider it unethical, and many school districts do this, I consider it unethical to use one test to identify a child as gifted. If I broke my toe the other day, and when I went to the doctor, she did not a test, but she did an assessment. She used various tools, including x-raying, to say my toe was broken. Some people would you go to a doctor and they just like touch your toe and was like, oh, it looks fine, and not use any equipment? So testing versus assessment. Testing is really making white middle-class students be privileged and who really shouldn't be a gifted programs, and doing the opposite for Black and Hispanic students.
Our guest is Dr. Donna Ford, who is a professor of education and the Cornelius Vanderbilt Endowed Chair in the College of Education at Vanderbilt University, and has been working in the field of culturally responsive gifted education and studying advanced placement and gifted definitions for decades now. She's giving a presentation at 4:30 this afternoon at Nazareth College titled Culturally Responsive Gifted Education and Educators, Models, Resources, and Strategies to Recruit and Retain Underrepresented Students of Color. After our only break of the hour, more of your feedback for her next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, can American free enterprise solve climate change? It's a question that will be addressed in an upcoming forum with former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis. He joins us to discuss possible climate policies, a carbon tax, and more. Then in our second hour, we discuss the future of grocery stores with writer John Steinman. His book is called Grocery Store: The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guest, Dr. Donna Ford from Vanderbilt University, as we're talking about the definition of what gifted is and how it's formed and what it means in this country. Not too long ago on this program, we welcomed students to the panel, and one of the students was an African-American student from Greece Arcadia High School, Kadane Malik. And Kadane had this to say about his own work in AP courses, being in gifted programs, and high academic achievement. By the time he was in high school, this was his perception of being among those programs. Let's listen.
The only negative reaction I got, which was strange, came from my fellow black students. And this is interesting. It's not the first time I've experienced this, but it manifested itself in, hey, I see you in an advanced class. I see you on the paper, on the news, whatever. And I see you with this clean record. You are not a genuine black student. And that's so shaking. It's strange to encounter those words from someone you consider kin, whether that is family, because that has happened in my nuclear family unit, but also just friends or people I thought were friends, students, classmates. And I have to say to them, so you're associating blackness, or you're associating your heritage and the pride that you have in your color with failure, with suspension, with disciplinary action. And I have to say, no, I'm proudly going to claim my African heritage, and I'm proudly going to claim being a black student and being successful and being advanced and going through my time in high school, dabbling in all these things, being good at whatever I can, and having an attitude of success.
That's Greece Arcadia student Kadane Malik. What do you make of that, Dr. Ford?
I empathize with this young man. I had the same experience going to that private school, and it does happen in families. So you are considered a sellout. So we have to, in the black community, work on this, but schools also. My friend, Dr. Margarita Bianco, says you can't be what you don't see. So if you see a lot of, let's say a black male, see a lot of football players and succeeding, that's what you want to be. They're not seeing teachers. Only 1% of teachers are black males. Only 1% are black Hispanic males. I mean, are Hispanic males. So I understand his experience, and I've been there. I did a study a number of years ago on almost 1,000 black students. They were from, I think, 5 different states. Some half were identified as gifted, half should have been identified as gifted. And I asked them, have you heard of acting white? And almost always had. And I said, have you been accused of white, of acting white? And about 75% said, yes, I've been accused.
The gifted students?
The whole sample.
The whole sample.
Because the other samples were high achieving.
Okay.
And they should have been identified as gifted.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not capturing it correctly. But so it is an issue. And this is when I work with teachers and families to promote racial pride in our students, period, but especially the higher achieving ones, because you have to get thick-skinned. I teach at Vanderbilt University, as you said, and we have a black university near us. I mean, very close. And I often get asked, why, you know, told I'm selling out, I'm acting white, because I work at this white university as opposed to an HBCU. And it does not bother me at all. So you have to work on not letting it bother you. If there are more black students and Hispanic in gifted programs, then you will see more like you and be inspired to be in those programs.
And there'll be less of what we might think of as a stigma?
Yes, Yes, yes. So I want listeners, I'm sorry, I keep saying readers. I want listeners to look up the work of John Ogbu. And he talks about voluntary, involuntary minorities. And his piece about the involuntary minorities is very telling, because part of that is where those, meaning slaves, my descendants, and some other, and Native Americans, et cetera, didn't ask to be here. And so if you didn't want us to be here, then, I mean, if I don't want to be here, then I'm going to have an attitude. And so when you want, so the belief is when you want to be like someone who has oppressed you, then you are selling out and you're acting white. And you also saw that during slavery, and where the, in particular, lighter skin slaves were in the house and got the, so to speak, better, less strenuous positions. And then those who were dark skinned were in the fields. So this has a long, long history, and it's problematic. I just read something this yesterday morning that said employers will give higher pay to their light-skinned black workers to the tune of 25% and lower pay to the darker-skinned ones doing the same thing. There's also data that indicates that if you are light-skinned, a light-skinned female, you will not be as disciplined as much as a dark-skinned female. So then the dark-skinned female is upset with the light-skinned female and accuses her of acting white. So it's not just something that happens in the community. It's also, it's complex, but it's promoted in schools in many ways.
All right. I want to try to get a couple more phone calls in, but before we do that, there was something that you wanted to bring up before the hour is out, which is a development in your field that troubles you. Tell me about this.
Recently, in the Journal of Gifted Child Quarterly, and that would be October, an article was published, and it was a vindication of Lewis Terman. Lewis Terman is considered the or one of the two founders of the eugenics movement, and one of his views, among many, is that blacks were not intelligent. Don't waste our time trying to educate them. Just make them, you know, get them a job. It is vile. And it's, if I wish I had prepared for that question, it just came to me. So thank you for asking it. But it is vile. It is racist. It is white supremacy. And it is going to move the field, and I believe the nation, backwards. Now, once that article came out, one of the authors decided that, with another author, well, you know, it's out there. So his name is Warney, and her name is Jolly. So a special issue of Gifted Child Quarterly is circulating, and it is a testimony, a legacy to Lewis Terman. And I don't see how anyone could believe that that is appropriate and not offensive and will not do harm to the field of education, but especially gifted education.
All right, let me get Bonnie in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Just a couple things. One is just to share this. So locally, there's been efforts going on now for at least a couple years, if not longer, to require teachers, all teachers really, and all education staff, required to participate in anti-racism education, meaning that learning that, because it's hard to see how some of these things, these attitudes, assumptions are played out if people don't even have an internalized view of what real racism is. And that doesn't necessarily make you a racist, but it makes you somebody who doesn't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing that, because in New York it's not required, and that's almost unbelievable after all these years why it wouldn't be. Well, we know why it wouldn't be, but so I there's no question that this, a lot of this sort of racism based. But I also want to say something else. I guess I'm a person that I get kind of a little antsy when we have a system of economics and everything else that keeps saying, well, you're better than the other one, you know more than the other one, you're this, you're that. And I think we need to kind of pull back on that as a whole system because it has so many negative connotations. So if I had my way, I would be pushing for education to be much more on an interdisciplinary model, which is a model that has many components to it, and it's much more holistic. And it also gives a chance for people to show whatever talent, skills, you know, insights, creativity you have without having to be played against somebody else. You know, you're not as smart as this one, you know. And I think that attitude also is not the most desirable to have. So how do we minimize that and still have people, you know, you want people who are competent, of course.
Right.
But you know, there's ways of doing that, and you can help people on the side more if you need them to do. But I the model, and it's I've heard that Finland is beginning to fully implement that program. I'm dying to see what happens. Hmm. So that's what I had to say.
Bonnie, thank you. Go ahead.
So in the context of the first part of what you was talking about, Connie, anti-racist education for teachers, for all, actually every discipline is essential. I mean, it's needed, for example, with police. Look how many black males in particular are being killed. I just saw something, a video that was, well, I couldn't watch the video, but a man was sleeping in his car. I think he was 22 at Taco Bell. I guess he had fallen asleep. And he was killed sleeping. Now, he did have, they said, a gun on the passenger seat. But how is somebody who has a gun going to shoot you? And they shot into that car I don't know how many times. And it just made me cry. That profiling also happens in schools, which is the reason for underrepresentation in gifted, overrepresentation in special ed, certain categories, overrepresentation for discipline and expulsion. So my problem is, my very deep concern is, I think the anti-racist training that many, if not most, teachers get is a farce. I don't think it goes deep enough, and I don't think it has teachers be reflective enough. And I am not really a fan of implicit bias. I think that lets people off the hook. I didn't mean to do that. But I am more a fan of explicit bias. I think too much of this is intentional. So the anti-racist training has to be serious and reflective. Talk about the problems as well as talk about solutions.
We're going to try to squeeze in one more. Got to be tight. Go ahead, Jen in Rochester.
Hi. The comment I had is that my son had ADHD, and he's also black, so he wasn't considered for the program, but I advocated for him. And that's because I had an opportunity to know about it. Not all parents do. So I really think it's a great idea for you to have the testing for everyone, even though the testing itself has its own biases in it. But that way it is taken out of the hands of the teachers who, you know, aren't necessarily going to think kids who have ADHD are going to be successful in those gifted programs. But that was my comment.
Yeah, Jen, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Dr. Ford.
Too few schools allow children to be labeled twice exceptional. There are absolutely children who are gifted with a learning disability, have ADHD and are gifted and more. But in some states, parents have to choose between one or the other. You can't be both. So more schools need to focus on twice exceptionality. And I'm sorry to hear that about your son.
Hmm. In our last minute or so, tell me what you would change immediately, if you could, about the way gifted and talented is evaluated and sort of carried out in this country.
What I would change immediately is to stop allowing teachers to make referrals. What I would allow, stop immediately is to allow parents to make referrals, because the higher income families have an advantage. What I would stop is to allow one test to be the sole way that students are identified as gifted. And what I want is for any and every teacher to get training in gifted education, so you really can know how to teach them. But when you get in that training, also get trained in multicultural education. And until that happens, we're gonna continue to see the data that we have. And when I was growing up, there was a saying, and it's still out there by the NAACP, and it said, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And I say, a mind is a terrible thing to erase. And that's what's happening to Black and Hispanic children.
Dr. Donna Ford, Professor of Education and the Cornelius Vanderbilt Endowed Chair in the College of Education at Vanderbilt University in Rochester today for a presentation at Nazareth College, 4:30 this afternoon. Thank you for spending the hour with us. Generous with your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope it makes a difference.
Well, thank you. And our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Dolores Parlato, the wonderful volunteer, and one of the nicest faces in this building. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you are going to have a wonderful weekend, and you'll be right back with us on Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.